there. This is the A Lot To Say podcast, a conversation-based project focused on unconventional career paths and the projects that consume us. I'm your host, Gary Williams, or Gaz, as many call me. And A Lot To Say is part of the Alt Projects family of content, obsessing about the overlap between creativity, technology, and culture. I'm fortunate to spend my days working alongside technologists, artists, researchers, and people who just generally give a damn about the world we live in. And I'm very lucky to be able to hear of some incredible career journeys over that time from some really inspiring people. So I am particularly energized by the projects that I hear people are experimenting and tinkering on along the way. And I thought, you know what, it's time to put these stories out there with the A Lot To Say podcast project. I can't wait for you to hopefully discover some new and lesser known stories about the things people get wrapped up in and what led them to this point. This is A Lot To Say. All right, hi. Welcome to episode 10 of A Lot To Say with Tim Scheel. He's a presenter on Triple J and he runs Spirit Level, which is an artist-run music label based in Melbourne. He's a proficient musician. I guess you could call it in the electronic slash experimental realm, but, you know, who really needs a categorization anymore anyways, you know? He's been producing some video game soundtracks of late that are just absolutely incredible, so we'll discuss that in the chat. But Tim founded Spirit Level in 2014 alongside his longtime collaborator and friend Wally DeBacker, aka Grammy Award-winning producer Gautier. Since then, it's grown into a thriving community that nurtures diverse creative voices from around the world, and it's just an incredible, fantastic label that I happily purchase whatever I can get my hands on from. In 2020, Spirit Level launched a creative music tech lab called The Lab, which explores how music can be extended via the use of emerging technologies. You know, they've been producing some fantastic engagement events this year in particular under the banner of Future of Music. First in person, of course, but then they've quickly shifted to new and interesting ways online once, you know, damn COVID-19 hit. So how do I know Tim? Look, we don't know each other crazy well. I've been following along with what he does for a long time now, though. Spirit Level actually produced this great article on Medium that I implore you to check out. It's really cool. It's titled 9 Things You Might Not Know About Spirit Level. I stumbled across it a little while ago and it just really spoke to me. It just again reinforces to me that, you know, the content you put out there, particularly written, can really effectively communicate what you're about and the message you convey or want to convey. And so for me personally, in that article, I just really loved the summary of the multiple projects that they've been involved in. And it further sort of reinforced, you know, sort of them and a number of others as, you know, creating businesses that people love. You know, so for me, they're right up the top of that list. You know, this podcast, it does cover career journeys, but I really love to emphasize just as much the projects that people really obsess over. And so this felt like a really good opportunity to chat about some of those with Tim directly. So I'm just really pleased he got involved, to be honest. And those video game soundtracks, holy shit, they are incredible. Specifically talking about Duet and The Gardens Between, we'll touch on those during the chat, but they are just phenomenal. And again, I implore you to check them out because they are just absolutely beautiful pieces. So what did we explore during the chat? Well, we cover interviewing your musical heroes on radio, appearing on Saturday Night Live in front of an audience of millions. We talk about apathy and the perception of wasted youth, about networks, and of course a fascination with emerging technologies and much more. He also has, you know, a far better podcast voice than me. So, you know, without further ado, this is episode 10. With Tim Scheel of Spirit Level and Triple J. Well, Tim Scheel, thanks so much for joining us for the A Lot To Say podcast. I'm stoked to have you on. So thank you very much for being here.
I'm stoked to be here, Gary. Thanks for having me.
Now, you for listeners who are finding out about you through this episode, you have a long and storied history of interviewing a lot of people. How often do you actually get interviewed yourself, I should ask?
Well, given that I'll do sort of 4 or 5 interviews a week with musicians and stuff for Double J generally and Triple J, the ratio is pretty out, but you know, I still get interviewed every now and then, but yeah, probably not heaps. My problem is that, you know, when I'm not doing radio, I'm an artist and I run this record label, but you know, as an artist, I'm not really my own best publicist. And I am technically my own publicist because I release my own music. And so I'm the guy that's meant to set up the interviews for me and do all the promo for my music. But, you know, I think because I tend to be so focused on trying to help all the other artists out, I often sort of forget about my own stuff. So yeah, I do a lot of interviews, but not often on this side. Yesterday I was in this exact room. I was in my bedroom talking into this microphone. Being the interviewer, talking to Kamasi Washington, jazz legend. So that was an incredible thing that I very lucky to do a lot, is talk to amazing people. And now I'm talking to Gary Williams. Also amazing.
Oh, look, you know, humble. I'm humbled as always. And I've seen some of the roster of people you've spoken to. I mean, even over the last short while, when we're talking about people like... we've got George Clinton and P-Funk, and then what was it, Noel Gallagher, and you know, it's just rich and diverse. How do you feel about constantly changing it up? I mean, you seem to have obviously a very fast interest in different genres of music, but how do you adjust to each different personality coming in? And do you find it better to, I guess, really focus on that interview, or do you just leave it casual and come what may?
I've ended up in a really fortunate position, I guess, because I, you know, through Double J, I get to speak to a really broad range of people from all kind of eras of music and all parts of the world. But then with my Triple J show, which is much more focused, I guess, on the music that is part of my own personal background, through that avenue, I get to talk to maybe not as famous names, like not as big names necessarily, but the artists who I personally think are hugely influential and important at the moment. So I'm just so lucky to be able to do that and talk to, I look back at the list of people I've spoken to in the last, you know, a few years, and I'm just gobsmacked really. But in terms of like preparing for an interview, you know, that's a podcast in itself, but
yeah,
I've kind of just learned by doing a little bit. I don't have any kind of journalism background. Interviewers don't necessarily have to have a journalism background. It is the kind of thing you can only really get better at by doing it. And I wouldn't say I'm like necessarily a fantastic interviewer, but the 10,000 hours rule, I guess you kind of get better at anything. I tend to find that as a general rule, there's a really good middle ground between being highly prepared, over-prepared, reading everything, and then also being completely open and in the moment to going in any direction. It's this really weird thing. Sometimes I think about it as you need to prepare to the point where you sort of know everything, and then you need to forget all of that.
Yeah.
So you can have the conversation, because especially on radio, you know, and on a radio show that's going out to a big, broad national audience, you're the proxy for the audience. So, you know, even though I might know everything about Holly Herndon, for example, like an artificial intelligence expert, musician, composer, I'm obsessed with her. I know her story in and out. 99.9% of Triple J listeners have no idea who she is, you know, for better or worse. My role is to try and help her share who she is with them. And if I already know her story backwards, and I assume a lot of knowledge when we speak, we're just going to have this inside baseball chat that doesn't help anyone.
That's right. So absolutely. I think
it's good. Sometimes I'm like, sometimes it's almost an excuse to not prepare, because you kind of go, you know, if I was over prepared, then, you know, I'm not going to be as curious. So maybe I won't prepare for this interview. My employers aren't listening to this, are they?
Yes, I hope not. But look, maybe they won't be the employers for too much longer. But anyway, look, I think that's a nice segue into it. I mean, today's episode, or what we're talking about, is largely unconventional career paths and then the projects that consume people. So that projects aspect has manifested in your life in numerous ways, as both in terms of the output that you have as a musician and various projects, and then also with, I guess, the label that you run, which is much more than a label in actuality. So we'll dive into that. But also, I think just in terms of what you were talking about in those conversations, yeah, it's about unearthing those stories which people find so valuable. So it's interesting to be the conduit when you need to know a fair amount, but it's about steering in the right direction. And we'll see whether I practice what I preach, I guess, today. Let's start a bit, though, with diving into, I guess, a bit of background is you are doing the music thing. You're heavily involved in video game scores. You're running a record label. You're presenting on Triple J in various various programs. You've done touring throughout the world. But where has it all sort of started? Was it an initial, I guess, in terms of your upbringing, deep interest in music initially? You venture into you're in the electronic realm heavily now. So was it initially piano through the keyboard, or how did that sort of manifest in your younger years?
Yeah, absolutely not. So my relationship with music starts with my parents, like a lot of people, I guess. As a kid, you know, I'd never thought about really having an interest in making music, but we listened to music all the time in the house. And my dad, you know, he wasn't officially in a band, but he had a bungalow with some keyboards and some guitars, and his brother and his mate would come around and the three of them would like record songs onto cassette tapes, and just he'd make his own artwork. They sort of kind of had their own pretend band that never played any gigs, and they never really shared their music or sent it to anyone, which is actually something that I feel like doesn't happen as much now as it maybe used to be a thing, that particularly through the 70s and 80s, this idea of like a private press, which is like a tape or a record that you made just for yourself or for your family, and you didn't sort of have ambitions beyond that. This is an interesting thing about being in the internet age, is that it's actually really hard, I think, for a lot of young musicians to stop at that point and just be happy, because it's so in their face, the access to getting online and finding an audience and building your brand and all that stuff. My dad never seemed to have much of an interest in any of that, but he made some really interesting music. And, you know, as a kid, I got to muck around on his Yamaha DX7, but I didn't think too much about it. But, you know, it's really obvious to anyone who has maybe noticed any part of anything I do, but like it won't be a surprise to anyone, I was a massive nerd. So, you know, I loved computers really early. So as a young kid, I was programming computers and pulling PCs apart and reassembling them. And I was that kid, you know, and still am in so many ways. My relationship with music, in terms of that idea that I could make music, happened when I was a teenager, and a friend of mine in high school was a violinist and a really good one. And he discovered grunge, like he discovered Soundgarden and Nirvana, and then convinced the rest of us that we should start a band because he could teach all of us how to play guitar and our various instruments. Playing power chords is so simple. So that combined with, because that's my kind of age. So like, I guess I was a teenager in the mid to late 90s, and I got heavily into grunge music and that alternative, whatever you want to call it, world. And something about that time with those bands, you know, especially like you think about Nirvana or even a Blink-182 or whatever, you could, as a teenager, or even better, you think about Silverchair. So they're about my age. And I, as a teenager, seeing Silverchair kind of explode onto Triple J and into touring and all that kind of stuff, looking at them and going, man, I could be Silverchair, was a really intoxicating idea. So for a hot minute in high school, like so many teenagers at that time, me and my mates were like, we could be Silverchair, you know, or whatever band. So that was that, I guess that's where I got the hook of like, okay, I can make music. Like, and I started, just after school, I would sit with a guitar in front of a stereo I had with a crappy mic that I must have rummaged around and found in dad's cupboard. And the mic, I could plug the mic into the stereo, and because the stereo was a double cassette deck, I could start taping like myself playing guitar onto one tape and then overdub that onto the second tape part on top, right? So, which is not rocket science, but as a kid who hadn't yet thought about that, and computer, you know, making music on computers, while it was definitely happening in the late 90s, especially in studios and stuff, it wasn't like I had a Mac laptop in my bedroom that I could just whip up GarageBand. Like that hadn't happened yet. So that was probably mucking around on the tape machine was where I started to think, okay, I can like collage music together. And then probably what happened, you know, long story short, it was, I don't know why it didn't happen earlier, but a couple of years after that, I guess like my taste in music broadened pretty radically at the same time as I realized that I could take this long standing love of computers that I'd had and my love of music and put them together. You know, I started finding software that I could muck around with, manipulating samples, you know, using Fruity Loops for the first time, using this really like pre-Ableton piece of software called Sony Acid, you know, getting into those pieces of software and realizing like, oh, I can chop up other bits of songs and put them together and turn them into these collages. And then I can, you know, I can plug this MIDI keyboard in, and that's when it kind of all exploded for me. And I was like, okay, I really can actually make music that feels authentic to me.
Yeah.
You know, and then it kind of, but that, yeah, from there, it only gets more complicated and strange, my odd journey.
We'll dive in. I mean, some of your musical output will be known by quite a few people around the world in terms of video game involvement. Video game scores or soundtracks. But before that, and I know there was sort of a bit of a moment for you verging into that where your interests align with opportunities, I guess. But what was that, I guess, that middle period where you started to, you were fucking around with, you know, all these different programs and obviously experimenting. Yeah. You're verging heavily into a mixture of traditional instruments and then obviously electronic manipulation. But then you started to get involved in various levels of musicianship with friends, touring, etc. So what was that period like, and before you progressed into the video game realm?
Yeah, so that's my 20s, basically, which were like a lot of my 20s was just me sitting around doing nothing, playing Xbox, staying up late and watching infomercials at 2 a.m. for no reason. Yeah. Like I had a really kind of empty, like kind of lost decade. Yeah,
the malaise of youth.
I think a lot of people do. There is this narrative of creative people who burst out of the gates just and off they go. Whereas I kind of look back at that period now as a time where, you know, in some ways I wasn't fully together as a person. And also in other ways, I was sort of hibernating and gestating, I think, in a way that was a pretty valuable time for me to. And
I was exactly the same.
Yeah, an amazing, I think probably a really great opportunity. And I was very lucky to have that, to be able to kind of just find these, you know, day jobs that would keep me going and have the support of friends and family and sort of not really be particularly focused in a way that I am kind of hyper productive now in a way that I couldn't have imagined when I was in my 20s. But to answer your question, I just kept mucking around. I found Ableton, which is, you know, music software.
Yeah.
That's now extremely ubiquitous. I found that with one of its earliest kind of incarnations, and just the way that program worked, its kind of workflow felt really native to me. And I just kept doing my thing. So in terms of what happened through my 20s, I just started self-releasing music, you know, getting my own CDs pressed and selling them through my website, sending music to local community stations in Melbourne, like Triple R and PBS and other stations around the country. And they kind of started to get behind it just a little bit, play it here and there. I never really did any touring or performing because I never really understood how I could translate my music, which was the sample based and this strange collage, not being a trained musician myself. I could never really figure out what I was meant to do on stage. So I never did it, which in hindsight I regret. But later in that period, I guess, one of my best mates is a guy called Wally DeBacco, who I met on my first day of university at Melbourne Uni at a philosophy lecture. You know, another friend of mine from high school who we'd enrolled in the same arts degree. The two of us walked into this lecture theatre, kind of, you know, like those nervous 17-year-olds, like, oh, we're in the big uni theatre, amazing, exciting, what do we do? And we're glad to have each other, I think. But then my mate Paul looked down the front of the lecture theatre and saw this like lanky, nerdy looking guy with a ponytail. And he said, that guy looks like him. He'd love music. We should go sit next to him. And we did. And that was Wally. And we talked about Depeche Mode and Ice House and, you know, and he became a really, really good friend. And then we have known each other, obviously now, what, 20 years or something. And I, yeah, we kind of, we were sort of approaching our music individually in some very similar ways. And so we would often be kind of sharing demos with each other and sharing tips with each other. And, but over those years, like watching kind of the Gautier engine sort of just keep cranking up to another gear was pretty, just to sort of be in the orbit of him as he kind of managed to push that into such an incredible space.
Yeah.
And yeah. Towards the end of that period, he'd asked me a couple of times to join his band because he needed someone who was across Ableton, which is what he was using to run a lot of the samples and MIDI and stuff for his live show.
Yeah.
He was doing it all himself because he's obviously ridiculously nerdy and talented. He was doing it all himself, but he wanted someone else to take over doing all of that stuff on stage so that he didn't have to think about it. So he could just concentrate on singing and connecting to his audience. And it just happened that I'd been doing my day job at the time was that I was the breakfast presenter for Triple R. I was part of Triple R's Breakfast, this show. And that sort of came to a close at around about the same time as he was gearing up to release this new album. And he, long story short, he asked me to join his band again. And this time I actually said yes. And it was good timing because 12 months later, you know, I was on the set of Saturday Night Live, you know.
Yeah, amazing. So,
and with in the first band that I'd ever been in, apart from my like high school bands.
So, yeah.
You know, I was like, again, like an incredibly fortunate thing for me, but also, you know, like a really unique chain of events to be in the position that I could do that. But at the same time, you know, I wouldn't have been able to execute that role in his band if I hadn't have kind of spent so much time, you know, learning how to use the software and developing, yeah, I guess, my own skill and my own passion and all of that stuff. So it was that kind of thing where it's like right time, but also prepared, you know, even though that's not ever what I was preparing for. Never ever did I think, hey, I might join a band for that has a number one single in 26 countries and two of the world, yeah, for 12 months. Like that was obviously, no one thinks that's my goal. And it never was, but when that opportunity sort of evolved, you know, I could kind of go along on the ride, which was, yeah, obviously amazing.
That is amazing. So, I mean, obviously incredible that you've toured the world with Wally under the Gautier project. But on that, how did you feel as you transitioned into the live realm? I guess out of the bedroom, so to speak. How influential was that jump into the live realm, as in you're now performing for there's a tangible audience, there's people, I mean, Gautier, they might not be looking directly at you all the time, but you can very appreciate rare. The irony.
Which is good, because it means that when you go on YouTube to watch the hundreds of videos that people have filmed, none of them are pointed at you, which is actually good. I don't want
true. A quick flash. Well, yeah, I mean, he's probably one of the rare instances where they're actually taking photos of the drummer at the very least. So.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
but yeah, the transition into the live experience. So for yourself, was that sort of formative, I guess, in terms of, I guess, harnessing or capturing that energy and then it having some sort of an influential effect on you later for what you started producing? Not that you've been hugely prolific in the live environment realm, but did that sort of start to inform, I guess, the basis of the spirit level beginnings, and then obviously assembling a roster under that record label?
It wasn't so much that experience influenced the music I made or the start of the label, but probably what that experience gave me above everything else was confidence.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure how it was going to go. Part of the reason why I'd never pursued live performance for my own music was that I didn't have the confidence to just get up there and see what happened, you know, because like I said, my music was sort of so complicated. I wasn't sure how I was meant to do it on stage. Getting, obviously, this, just seeing how Wally had it all set up was kind of useful because it gave me some tools. I kind of went, oh, okay, this is how he does it. This is really interesting to learn. But on a much more basic level than that, I just remember my first show with Gautier, which was my first real show on stage with the band, was at the National Theatre in St Kilda. And it was maybe 12 to 18 months maybe 12 months before like any of the big international stuff, all that kind of weird thing started kicking off, I guess. And I remember being pretty nervous, you know, because I just wasn't sure how I was going to cope once I got up there, you know, and just like, I remember taking myself out after sound check. I said, look, guys, I'm just going to go and like grab dinner on my own. You know, instead of all hanging out backstage and psyching ourselves up for the show, I'm just going to go and I think I just need to go for a walk, which I think was probably good, like good knowing myself, which I've gotten better at, you know, is that idea of like knowing where your head is at and what you need right now in order to cope. So, you know, I'm feeling really edgy, physically feeling really edgy. And I found a little cafe in St Kilda, found a little cafe, just ordered whatever and started just reading this book. I was reading like a science fiction book, Kim Stanley Robinson, Mars book, I think. And put my head into that for an hour and just started to feel like just distracted myself from thinking about what all of those people are going to think of me, you know, when I'm on stage. What are they going to think of me? Oh no. Am I going to remember to press all the right buttons? And I sort of forgot about that. And then I put the book away and then I walked back to the venue and walked in the back door and I felt fine. And then the closer the gig got, the better I felt about it. And it was just that thing where I would never have known if I hadn't have just tried it, that I was totally fine and actually very, very happy to do it. So it's like, I remember walking out onto the stage, just thinking like, I'm so pumped. I'm ready. Like, I'm so excited. And then as soon as I got out there to my little station with my keyboards, and I think I was playing guitar at the time on a couple of songs, it's just like, and it was just kind of like, oh yeah, this is the thing. Like I'm here to do this, you know? And that was such a revelation because I had no idea how I was going to respond. And I know plenty of people who deal with really intense stage fright and nerves, even with things like public speaking. And I've been that person in the past. But for whatever reason, I felt so confident in that moment. And then my confidence just sort of grew as the show evolved and we added more band members and we toured different places and played bigger and bigger shows. And, you know, I mean, I'd be lying if I said I didn't, we all didn't get nervous when we did some of those live TV events or, you know, Coachella Festival or like those moments, especially those moments where you know that you're a part of a machine that's been set up to really try and make a wonderful thing happen for one of your mates. Right. So that there is a pressure there, like, and it's kind of a pressure less than, it's not quite nerves. It's more just like, I really want this to go well because, you know, that's my mate and this is his thing. And so I hope that we get this right. But, you know, I guess coming out of that whole experience, just as a person on a purely just personality level, I had a lot more confidence that I could achieve a thing, you know, I could pull together be part of a pretty amazing thing and do it confidently and really well, you know? And I think anybody in their lives should try and find that moment, you know?
Yeah, certainly.
It doesn't have to be, I mean, I'm going to sound like a dick talking about the guy that was on the Coachella stage or whatever. It's just like, I mean, and that's not a unique experience, but it is also not a thing that everyone gets to do. But I think everyone can relate to that feeling of doing something and nailing it and going like, I feel great about myself because I did it. And it's like, it sounds dumb, but that can be like cooking dinner, you know. Like, you can cook a pasta and go, this pasta is the best. Like, this is amazing. I'm amazing. I like letting yourself have that feeling and then trying to hold on to that confidence and take it through to that next project, that next moment, that next day. I found that really valuable. So, you know, that was in a few different ways, I guess, doing that, having that experience was a turning point. And then everything from there, I could approach with a certain level of confidence in my own ability. And then whenever I doubt myself, which I do often, I can kind of, you know, that's one of the things I can look back at now and go, well, you know,
I did good.
It's okay to doubt myself, but at the same time, you know, if I just concentrate and work hard and focus on the things I'm passionate about, I can probably do something pretty cool. So I just try and I'm really fortunate to be able to look back on that experience and go and take so much from that at in any given moment from now on.
I love that. I love that, Seth. That's amazing. I think around leaning into new things as well, like we will now touch on your output in the last few years, and please do add to it with additional things, because I know there's multiple things that you've been wrapped up in. But two very well-known ones would be your score for Duet, which is an absolutely incredible game. I must say, like the two games I'll reference and then additional ones, they just came at pretty really nice points in my life personally, and your score was a massive part of it. So the two games I'll reference is Duet, which came out in I think 2013 or yeah. So, and then the Gardens Between, which I recently played on Switch, and both of them just incredibly affecting ones. Duet for the purposes of, I guess, had this great flow element, but I just connected immediately to the soundtrack. And a nice piece of irony being that you were talking before about mucking around on tapes is this sort of signature sort of sound throughout that Duet soundtrack, which is almost like the sound rewinding, which I think you put together on a Teenage Engineering OP1 keyboard, which is one of your loves, I guess. But talk us through getting into game score and getting involved more within that industry, because I've heard a little bit about it, but I'd love to know that transition from doing that experimentation in the realm that you do with multiple instruments, and then verging into a completely new realm, embracing the unknown, I guess.
Yeah. Well, firstly, that's so kind. So thank you.
Like, my pleasure. Amazing.
Thank you. So yeah, well, I guess this is kind of chronological a little bit. After the Gautier touring finished, which became pretty much a full-time job without much time to work on other projects, which was great. You know, that wrapped up while he kind of decided that he was going to focus on making new music. So it was a very clear end point to touring, which is not always the case with bands, especially bands who achieve that kind of level of audience will often just keep touring and just keep gigging. And we'll just, you know, we've been asked to do a tour around Germany. Let's go. But, you know, he put a very clear stop to that cycle, which I think in a way was really good, because it meant that all of us involved with the project could confidently try and move on to the next thing, you know? So I wasn't sure what that was going to be. And I never really have been. I don't know if you've picked up on that as a thread, but that's a big foundational part of my story, is that I never really know what's coming next. And that's, I enjoy that.
Yep.
But I did, I essentially watched a documentary about the independent gaming community. Indie Game the Movie, which is not so much about the broader community, but I guess it's about these three developers who are making different indie games, and about their, the nuts and bolts of how they make their games, what they go through in order to do it, and then the process of getting them out. Because I at that point, and I think a lot of people still don't know, but at that point I didn't know about the independent gaming like ecosystem at all, which is kind of funny, because I have this music background, and through various reasons, like I have a fairly clear overview of the commercial side of music, like the higher end of the music business, down to the independent ecosystem, and how those two things can be so different. There's overlap, but they have different goals. They have different kinds of people working in them. They have different financial realities. You know, there is a bit of a demarcation, but a big blurry bit in the middle. It had never occurred to me, like I'd always been a gamer and I'd always loved playing games, but I'd always pretty much played AAA games. And I, at that point I hadn't really gotten into indie games or mobile gaming in a big way. I guess I had some sense that it existed, and watching that movie and just realizing, like, okay, you can't draw clean parallels, but essentially, in the same way you've got an independent music scene globally and also in different cities around the world, gaming has an independent scene where it is not about these big structures so much. It's about small teams working on passion projects. You know, so it's watching that movie just made me go, I want to find that scene, because we must have that in Melbourne. And like, I love games, and you know, and even like, even specifically listening to the soundtrack, like that movie was scored by Jim Guthrie, who I loved the soundtrack. So I got really curious about him and I looked him up, and it turned out he was this Canadian sort of independent musician who had been on some labels and in some bands. And then he kind of just stumbled his way into a big successful indie game. And then after that became a guy who made indie game music.
Yeah, amazing.
I mean, and so I just sort of like, I looked at him and I kind of thought, oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, you see yourself in him. Yeah.
A little bit, yeah. So I literally jumped on Facebook the next morning and I used Facebook for, I think, the only thing that it's good for now, which is, and I just said to my network, like, who do I know that knows game developers? You know, like, I just want to meet some. And because I've been fortunate enough to pick up a bunch of, you know, acquaintances and friends over time, it turned out that a friend of mine from Triple R, her partner, you know, was essentially involved in like games funding. Like he was part of a funding body for local indie game developers. And so, and he was a fan of my music. He knew who I was through Triple R, and he just said, Tim, you should go and meet with this person. You should meet with that person. And it was so valuable for me. And I had a handful of coffees, just sort of like getting my head around how the scene works and who's doing interesting things in Melbourne. Mm. I was advised to go to the IGDA meetups, which is the Independent Game Developers Association, which is like an international collection of chapters of game developers. And at the time they were doing these regular meetups at the Kelvin Club, which I went to a couple of. And then PAX came to Melbourne for the first time, the big game conference. And so I went to that too. So it was this kind of like, I just had this spark of like, I just want to get into that. And then I was able to kind of just find my way to a couple of the right people. And one of those meetings was with Kumobius, who just happened to be finishing Duet and needed some sort of audio, you know, they needed music. They wanted music. And we got along, we had the same reference points. And in one afternoon, I wrote probably half the soundtrack and sent it to them. I was like, I sent it to them as demos, like including kind of the main Duet theme. I sort of went, oh, this sort of just came out while I was watching footage of, your demo build. It feels good, but what do you guys think? And they were like, yeah, this would be fine. And then I was like, no, can I work on it a bit more? And then worked on it for a couple of months and it evolved into an album but then evolved into another EP and then a remix album. And then, and I kind of got involved with all the sound effects and one of the early updates to Duet the game was adding voice narration, which I also kind of was able to push through as an idea. And I'm really glad that we were able to add that. So I was able to record a really great friend of mine, Jojo, to get her to kind of voice the narrative for that game. Cause that game is such a simple arcade game at its heart, but it does have these words that come up. It has these little sentences that come up that actually for a lot of players become really emotionally affecting. And so to add voice narration and actually have her be able to vocalize these thoughts, because a lot of the narration is based around the stages of grief. So to have her voice in your ears during that experience it was one of a few things I think that kind of elevated Duet past a lot of the other kind of just Twitch mobile games.
And I mean, for me personally, you know, it. I probably got into it very late after it's released, but definitely at the perfect time for my life, I guess. So, you know, I guess the connection with it had something to do with, you know, a particularly sort of anxious time in my life based on just too much happening all at once. And then I just found, like, just with that, I've always had a love of gaming, but that particular game, it just really realigned my brain in some ways, because it just allowed me to focus, and I just absolutely loved it and connected with it. I mean, for listeners who are unfamiliar with Duet, it ain't no slouch. It was awarded Game of the Year by the New Yorker, Apple, and many others. Incredible soundtrack, which is available on Spotify and other streaming platforms. So just a wonderful game that everyone should check out. And also looping back on the PAX environment, I mean, it is incredible. You must have really enjoyed, with your natural curiosity, finding out this, again, this undercurrent of this rich amount of indie game developers, particularly in the city that you call home. So Melbourne's flush with incredible amount of indie game developers, and they're all on show at PAX, which is just a really rewarding thing. Some will call it an epilepsy-inducing environment when you get in, because there's just shit happening everywhere. There's lights and sounds and people, but stunning.
Melbourne has a world-class indie gaming community, and it's known around the world as a place where games come from, where successful and also really creative games come from. So, and PAX, it is wild. Like, it's the giant kind of the AAA studios are all there, and the big publishers are all there, and they have their massive like World of Tanks stage where they have booth babes and gross things, and that's an element of PAX, and that can be enjoyable too. But for me, going for the first time, just being able to walk around the indie section where all the developers are showing the games that they're working on that aren't necessarily out yet.
Yeah.
And they're all there. So you could walk over, play a game that seems interesting, and then talk directly to the person that's made it and go, tell me how you made it. Like, it's such an incredible
thing. It's amazing.
There's not really a parallel in music, and I kind of wish there was. Like, imagine a music event where you've just got a bunch of local artists and labels who are working on music at the moment. Like, they're working on an album or a song or whatever. And they all set up these real life booths in a big conference room. And you, as like an aspiring musician, can just kind of come in and just walk up to Courtney Barnett, and she gives you a pair of headphones and goes, this is a demo I'm working on. And you can just go, oh, this is great, Courtney. Like, what are you going to do with this bridge? It's not quite there yet, is it? Yeah. Like, it's so like, for anyone who, like, when people, I do get asked, like, how do you get into game music? And that's how, is you go and meet game developers and you start to understand how they speak and what's important to them and figure out where your place might be. And to have a physical location, I'm not sure if PAX is going to happen this year. I hope so.
Yeah.
But, it will eventually return, and such a valuable thing. Yeah.
Well, we'll get stuck into Spirit Level in just one second, but we'll continue on briefly on that Melbourne flavour in the game development community with The Gardens Between, which you also scored. Absolutely stunning, stunning game, both visually and sound-wise, and inherently a story about, friendship and connection, remembrance and nostalgia. It's just incredibly affecting once again, and I've just loved it. Mac Game of the Year achieved an Apple Design Award, and just stunning achievement, which is on Switch and PS4 and Steam, I think. But again, you've continued on with the Voxel Agents, who are also based in Melbourne. So tell us a bit about your continued progression through these games and continuing to, I guess, bring this really essential flavour to them, and how proud you feel about the output in the end.
Oh, incredibly proud. I'm so lucky to... Mm-hmm. I've worked on three games, since 2013. Duet, a game called Induction, which was made by an English developer called Brian Gale, who I met at a PAX event in the States. And then The Gardens Between. And I'm proud of all three of those games, but I'm also, again, just fortunate that I've had the opportunity to be offered those projects to work on. After Duet, I did get hit up. There was a period there where I was getting hit up a lot by anonymous game developers from around the world, sort of saying like, I've got an iOS game where it's a spaceship and you're dodging asteroids, and I just need a 30-second loop and 5 sound effects assets. Can you give me a quote? And there was a moment there where I was like, oh, I could be now a game audio designer if I would like, and there's a parallel universe where that happened, and maybe that was the right thing to do for me, who knows, financially or whatever. But I know myself to know that that's not a thing that I really am necessarily best at or want to do, to kind of be a game audio machine. I give credit to the people who do that. That's a different set of skills to, I think, the skills that I've developed, which are a bit more creative. Not more creative, but just more esoteric, I guess, is the best way of putting it. So I met Henrik, who's the lead developer for The Gardens Between, probably only a year or so after Duet was released, because The Gardens Between ended up having like a 4 or 5 year development period from memory, maybe four.
Right.
I mean, Henrik had already been working on a demo of the earliest gameplay version of The Gardens Between before I met with him. And he had decided wisely that he wanted to pull together the entire creative team before really getting into the guts of working on the game. So the game didn't have a name. It didn't have a concept, really. Like, it didn't have a narrative. All it had was this mechanic. So for anyone who's played the game, The Gardens Between, the core mechanic is that you control these two characters who are exploring islands, but you don't move the characters, you move time. So they're on a set track. They're on a set pathway around the island interacting with different objects, and they can't deviate from that path. All you can do is control where they are in that path, forwards and backwards in time. And it's one of those things where he showed that to me on an iPad, the really basic version of it, of that game mechanic. And I instantly loved mucking around with it. Like, my finger just wanted to play with it. And just like, it had this amazing subversive feeling and this idea of like, I can control time. And just, it felt that feeling of, if you've played a bunch of games, the same thing with music. It's like, if you've played a bunch of games and then you play a game and you go, I've never done this before in a game. If you have played a lot of games, that is such a rare feeling and a really valuable feeling. And I mean, I hunt that same feeling as a music fan and with the label and with the radio shows as well. It's like, if when I hear something that I'm really, really excited by and connected to, and I also haven't really heard before, that's incredible. So I pretty much was hooked instantly, but plus already looked beautiful before Henrik enlisted, you know, an amazing illustrator and animation designer to come on board. So he also brought on a really great narrative designer, and it took a few years, but the game evolved into something so much more special than even I could have imagined. So it was such a joy to be involved during the whole process. So the music iterated a lot over the years, just like the game itself did. So there's a whole bunch of like Gardens Between music that didn't make it into the game because the game shifted tone or whatever. Just like there's heaps of levels and characters and story ideas that are on the cutting room floor. But to be involved in the game of that kind of scale in terms of development was really interesting, especially because Duet was the opposite. You know, like Duet, an incredible game, but it really was, you know, they found a game mechanic as well that I thought was really unique. And then they just honed that over a period of a couple of months, and then bang, the game was out. And that was perfect for Duet. To be on the opposite side, Gardens Between, was a really interesting experience too. So yeah.
Amazing. Check those games out, Duet and The Gardens Between. Incredible. But look, let's, as we get towards the end of our chat, I've thoroughly enjoyed it. It's so good to know so much more about your background. But let's talk about Spirit Level, because I guess we're talking about projects, and Spirit Level is, I guess emanated as a record company, but you're starting to develop it in some really, really interesting ways. I guess you're particularly influenced by people like Holly Herndon. So you're exploring elements of artificial intelligence, whether by investigation or running Future of Music meetups with Acme in the city of Melbourne, which you're now doing online. But I'll give a brief overview of what I've ascertained from Spirit Level. So you were named as one of the 5 best independent record labels in Australia in the 2019 Independent Record Labels Association Awards, which is very cool. You've run festivals throughout the meat market where you were based at one point. You're working with Norwegian bands. You're utilising interaction designers. You've got an incredible roster of artists. You've got Brailleface, who produces just amazing things. Was it 12 albums in a year, so to speak?
Yeah.
And you just keep doing it, partnering with groups such as Nura for double A-sides for record releases, delivering podcasts and more. It's a hefty amount of output, but where do you see Spirit Level now compared to when you ran it? And what is it exactly in your own mind at this current time?
I have a lot of trouble articulating what Spirit Level is. Even just hearing you describe it then, it made me think, man, what the hell are we? Like, you know, that idea of an elevator pitch that, you know, if you really want to get them involved with what you're doing, you need to be able to go, we're this.
Yeah.
I'm hopeless at that as a general rule. And I think it's because, you know, Spirit Level, like a lot of the projects that I've been involved with over the years, you know, is a lot of it is driven by my own curiosity, you know. So I am just very interested in things, and Spirit Level has become a vehicle for, you know, for those interests. And so I'm deeply passionate about music. And so the roster of Spirit Level has evolved to sort of reflect people who I really care about, who are making music that I think is really interesting and yep. unique. So fundamentally, that's what Spirit Level is. Sometimes I've always had troubles with the term label, record label, just because I think there has been and continues to be and should be a complete redefinition of what a record label is from the traditional idea. You know, what we're doing is not a company that manages the rights of artists, you know, their recording rights. Like traditionally, let's say decades ago, that's a record label, right? And there's plenty of labels who still are that model. So you sign an artist to a contract so that you can manage their recordings, which means selling those recordings into physical or digital stores and then sharing those profits with the artist and then achieving marketing outcomes around it. Like that's a really boring and not a fair definition of a record label. So I've never come up with another term, you know. Community isn't quite right because it feels a bit wishy-washy. So I like to say that we're like an artist-run label, because that is probably something that defines Spirit Level against some other labels, is that, you know, I'm an artist and all of the other artists on the label are involved in the decisions we make and the priorities that we have. They're all excited to share each other's music and to support each other on a human level. So, you know, the other way I've described Spirit Level in the past is as a support group.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you could start me on quite a long rant here, Gary, but you know, I tend to think that the music industry at large is highly delusional. So artists are kind of in the trickiest spot out of anybody who is involved in music, in the sense that they provide the creative work that is the engine for all of it, the whole ecosystem, but they often have the least support, least stability, and the most kind of complex psychological challenges. So I think in the modern times, and with priorities shifting and just in line with my own personal priorities, you know, a label should be a place where artists feel safe and can support each other. Look, if I can help achieve financial outcomes for my artists, that would be great. But I'm also really open with them as to how challenging that is. And I think that even being open and honest about that is as important as anything. So that's the kind of... I guess that's an inkling of the relationships that we foster internally with Spirit Level. But in terms of some of the other things that you mentioned, yeah, I going back all the way back to being a nerd programming computers when I was a little kid, like I've obviously always been interested in technology. Music, the way music interacts with technology, I think is fascinating because it's often a little bit ahead of some of the other arts industries. And, you know, it's been described as kind of like canary in the coal mine sometimes, in terms of disruption in the last 10, 20 years. And I find that pretty fascinating as well. So that's essentially where Spirit Level's kind of tech, our leaning towards that comes from. It comes from a desire and a curiosity again about what's going to happen next. You know,
yep.
And what's happening now, not just in music, but broadly with technology and culture, and how might that apply to music? How might that change music? And so, you know, the example of machine learning and how that really is an undercurrent of technology that is wildly disruptive and still underestimated. Thinking and talking about what that might do to music is something I think that's important and is not done enough, particularly in the music industry and the creative industries at large. So that's why, you know, like, yeah, it'd be great. I mean, we've talked about it and we're still thinking about, you know, can we develop a machine learning based project? Can we do something cool? Can we make some cool project? But I'm actually just as proud of the meetups that we're having and the conversations that we're starting, because I think, you know, executing projects takes time and resources and all of that kind of stuff. And
yeah,
we've started this project, The Lab, with Spirit Level, with myself and my partner, Namala Shom, who's kind of driving this innovation lab idea. But to be completely honest, like it is difficult to find the resources and the funding to achieve outcomes and like to achieve projects. So we've focused, at least to begin with, largely on conversations and just trying to educate ourselves, educate the artists on our label, and then just open spaces where people can talk about things, talk about some of these new technologies or new ideas so that we can all just kind of get a bit of a run up or a bit of a head start on things that might be coming.
I guess your intuition would lead you to, I guess, elements such as in the past when you've put a call out to a Facebook group or your Facebook just to say, hey, I'm looking to do this. Looking to, who knows, people in the game industry, for example, and then, fate or serendipity will lead you into, various conversations or opportunities. I did see a talk that Namala gave for Monash Sensilab, I think, just the other week, and it did break down a lot more about your like spirit level's willingness to experiment. And from an external person myself, that is very obvious and apparent as you dive through what you've sort of been putting out there, because it is definitely about the embracing of technology to inspire new and unheard of projects, but B, you definitely wrap your arms around your roster and the wider music industry as well. So I really love that sort of double play, the support internally with what's part of your family, but then also casting a lens to what the opportunities could be in the future. I mean, if AI can write a Eurovision winning, track, well then, but I think also people really need, if they're starting to come to terms with, come to an understanding of terms such as artificial intelligence, machine learning, neural networks, etc., they need to see it in example or in situ to then maybe understand a bit more about how it works rather than being a theoretical concept.
Yeah, that's what fascinates me. Like those are the projects that I get really excited about. Projects like OpenAI Jukebox, which just launched, which is like the most advanced neural network for kind of replicating existing genres and styles and artists. It's not so much like, I don't tend to look at that stuff and go, wow, what a great commercial opportunity, or I could make a great marketing asset for an artist with something like this. I look at that and I just go, wow, there's so much potential for this to educate more people about a technology that is becoming increasingly fundamental to how we are governed and how we are sold things and, like the structures of our life. That's the stuff that on some broader level, that's where I get inspired, is like, without getting too off the deep end, because I'm not qualified really to get off the deep end, but what's the function of art and culture in society from a noble perspective? It's to reflect kind of ourselves back at ourselves and to pull back the curtain on things that maybe are invisible intentionally or otherwise. And so that's the projects like that get me excited. Projects like thispersondoesnotexist.com, where you can visit that website and it'll show you a artificially generated picture of a person that looks 100% as if it's a real person. And you can just sit there and refresh it and just see hundreds of people that don't exist, but the photos are just completely photorealistic.
Yeah.
I get excited. I mean, I get excited on a fundamental giddy nerd level because I see it and I go, oh, wow, cool. But then I get really excited because I think, well, I want to share this URL, like this project, with everyone I know so that they can understand what's happening. Like they have, so that they have visibility to this quite powerful technology that within, 5 years, we'll all have more. Everyone will have more of an understanding of. But it would be good if more people knew about how it all worked now, probably.
Yeah, it's easy to, if you see a deep fake on online for the first time, you might find it amusing to see, I saw one with Bill Hader's face over the T-1000 Terminator.
Yeah,
but then
the Al Pacino ones that were there.
Yeah, crazy. But it's just that, but then potentially that might really cause some alarm for people internally as they start to dive into a bit more about what the what the future could hold. Look, this wasn't meant to be a philosophical
discussion. No, but I love this stuff. And when you think about that, people will often post those AI like deepfakes and stuff on their Facebook or whatever, and they'll go, oh, this is so cool, but it's so scary. I think it's the role of an artist to take that and try and process that for people to kind of go, okay, well, why is this scary and what does it mean? You know, I mean, I think also academics and writers and journalists play a very important role in trying to process all of that too. But I think, you know, art, culture, that includes musicians, that's part of the noble function of art, is to kind of go, why is that scary? And what do you do with that feeling? And, you know, I think artistic projects are often the things that can actually cut through yeah. with those ideas and change people's opinions or even just help them reflect and find their own actual opinion on a thing, as opposed to just a kind of a gut reaction, you know?
Certainly. Yeah, certainly. Look, Tim, we're going to wrap it up now, but I think for any listeners, it probably won't be unrealistic for us to do some in-person stuff in the future. So I'm sure there'll be some sort of an event or gathering that we can put together discussing a lot more of these concepts. But look, I want to thank you so much for appearing today. I've really appreciated our chat. I've just long been fascinated with many of the things that you do and the many projects that you get involved in. I had asked this question of one of our other guests, but when you have much going on, and then of course also a family, so plenty of things occupying your time. But when the night's quiet and you know you're alone with your thoughts, where's the mind wander for you?
Oh, my mind doesn't wander that much. I'm asleep generally. That's 'cause I'm kind of like, yeah. I think at some point I'm going to look back at this period of my life and be thankful that I was working so hard, but also be really thankful that it's over.
Yeah.
But probably, you know, the thing, if I could magically clear a whole bunch of space for myself, I would actually really love to get into game design. That's where my mind goes a lot of the time. You know, I've got a board games through to video games. I've always had this kind of fascination around mechanics and how to tell stories and how kind of narratives emerge from mechanics, which is a really fascinating thing about, especially the games that I kind of adore the most. They tend to be games where the game itself doesn't tell a story. The game is just a set of tools that you interact with, and the story kind of takes place in your head. I love games like that. So, you know, when I do kind of have that moment where I can kind of clear my mind of everything else that I'm really passionate about and really trying to make happen, and that's when I'll open up that Google Doc and I'll start, you know, brainstorming the card game that I've that I want, or that, you know, that weird idea for a mobile game that I had. Like, you know, that's kind of my, if I have a hobby, and I don't, that would be it, I think, game design. Yeah.
Amazing. Look, I won't labor it too much. Thank you so much once again. So for anyone listening to investigate more, do check out Spirit Level across online. Also yourself, Tim, you're at Tim Shiel, TimSHIEL on Twitter, and follow along both for a lot of Spirit Level and also Triple J content. But been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, so kind. So much fun.
So that was my chat with Tim Shiel as part of the A Lot To Say podcast. I've absolutely loved having him as part of it. And I was really chuffed when he said yes, as I was with plenty of others. So you can follow along with Tim on social media at Tim Shiel on Twitter and Instagram. And then, of course, Spirit Level. It's at Spirit Level Co on Twitter and Instagram as well. So I've been your host, Gaz Williams. Music on this podcast is by my band, Bateman. We don't exist anymore, but you can still find us on Bandcamp. And the music was programmed by our drummer, Gareth Leach. You can follow A Lot To Say on the Alt Projects social media channels at Alt Projects. Thanks, Tim, for joining. See you all in the next episode. Cheers.